Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. Sunday night into Monday morning. And Monday morning, my dad always calls in and tell a joke. He'll do that like right before 4 o'clock this morning. We are here from 11 to 4. Rod Pyle is going to join us to talk some space stuff. And we've got lots of other things happening on the show. As always, 312-981-7200 for talk and text. You can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show and stay connected on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. All right. So it is that time of week. Where Eric Childress and Steve Procopi join me. We talk about the brand new movies, review them all, and then talk about the weekend box office report as well. So let's get the guys in here. Here's Eric. Hi, Eric.
Hello.
All right. And Steve, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right. Before we get into the new movies and all that cool stuff, Steve, you are part of the wonderful Music Box Theater.
Yes.
And I understand that you guys have some really great holiday events and programming happening. Why don't you tell everybody about what they can do for the holiday season at the Music Box?
Sure. Yeah, there's a couple things. One, we've been doing for 36 years, and that's the world-famous Christmas sing-along double feature. I think there's a total of something like 32 shows across 11 days. And basically, they just double bill White Christmas and It's a Wonderful Life, and in between, there's Dennis Scott, our organist, comes out and plays, and there's a guy dressed like Santa who who comes out and sings, and there's, you know, the words to the Christmas carols are on the screen, and everyone's singing along, and every show tends to sell out, and it actually, those shows start this coming Thursday. Mm-hmm. They just go all the way pretty much through Christmas Eve, and it's a ton of fun. I think it's the only event we do all year where there's assigned seating, because we want to make sure everybody gets in who actually pays for a seat. No coats on the chairs next year or anything. So, and you can experience, we actually just replaced the front center section of seats. So those seats are brand new.
Wow.
And we're going to it's going to be a ongoing project over the next, however many months, of just doing like a section at a time when we're sort of having a slight down period. And we did it just before Thanksgiving, this first section. So
yeah.
Everyone's...
Well, some of those seats needed to be replaced, Steve.
A lot of them in that section did, because they were broken. But yeah.
I'll tell you something. Having spent, you know, the 24 hours of the music box, the festival, the horror festival.
Yes.
Those seats would take a toll.
Well, there's hopefully they'll take a slightly reduced toll now. So,
yeah, well,
so then the other thing is that we only do a couple shows of these, but we do something called the Alternative Christmas Double Feature. It's where we play it's different every year, but this year we're doing Elf and Love Actually, and again, like six shows over just a couple different nights. No sing along component, I don't believe, but just something for, you know, slightly more grown-up people.
And it's amazing how those two movies have become Christmas classics.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
really,
yeah,
seriously.
Sure.
Yeah.
For sure. It's like I said, it's a ton of fun. Almost every show tends to sell out, because like giant groups of people come all together. And, go on to the musicboxtheater.com website and just get your tickets, see what the show times are.
Let me just say this. I've been to the sing-along a couple of times, and it's a blast. It is.
Yeah.
It is a blast, and it gets you, no matter what kind of spirit you're in before you walk in. You are in the Christmas spirit when it's over.
People are dressing up. It's a blast, and it's just like the theater just feels different. It feels very ageless in those moments.
There's no question about it, and it's such a beautiful. It's a beautiful place anyway.
Yeah,
but to actually experience something that much fun and that seasonal, it really. I can't recommend it highly enough. It's
great. Sure. Yeah.
So, all right. So there's some of the stuff that's happening. Go to musicboxtheater.com for more info, you can find out exactly what's happening there. And speaking of the Music Box, Steve, why don't you tell us about Varda by Agnes?
Sure thing. Playing at the Music Box. It's a documentary on and by the prolific French New Wave filmmaker who died at the age of 90 just back in March of this year. She remained a vital, vibrant voice in film for more than 60 years. That's about how long her career was. I think her first sort of big celebrated film was something called Cleo from 5 to 7. Mm-hmm.
She was a remarkable filmmaker.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I mean really astonishing.
Really, like, championed making films about people that just didn't get films made about them. And she kind of worked throughout the 60s alongside and was respected as much as filmmakers like Godard and Demi. And Demi she ended up marrying and having a son with. But so this film sort of is basically filmed interviews with her on stage, either during lectures or, you know, Q&As after screenings of specific films. And they edit these together so that you're basically walking through her career chronologically. And I think actually a lot of people were probably introduced to her for the first time just a couple years ago when she got an Oscar nomination for a documentary called Faces Places that she was in, which is a fantastic film. And it's covered here at, you know, at the end, obviously. But it's so strange that maybe not at the age of 90 that this was her last film, final project about herself and its reflection and talking about her legacy. And you know, directing a film about yourself may seem a little sketchy, but she has always been a part of her films in some way. You know, sometimes as a narrator, sometimes she's in the films. But it doesn't really feel that odd that she's a part of this, it's about her, or that this was her final project. As I said, it walks through Cleo, it walks through, and sometimes they get people who were involved in these movies as well, who were on stage with her perhaps at the time. There's a great section where she's talking about the movie Vagabond.
That was the first movie that I saw. Of hers, and it's one of it's one of my favorite movies of all time.
And Sandrine Bonnaire, the star of it, that was her first movie, I think. So the two of them are together talking about the film and recounting some really grueling filmmaking conditions.
Yeah.
But it didn't really seem to matter to Bonnaire. She's like, I would have done anything for you, and she practically did, I think. But she was just so happy to be a part of something that she knew was special and meaningful and worthwhile. And as someone like I guess both of us, who've always enjoyed and appreciated Agnes Varda's work, the film is exactly the type of sort of cinematic tour that anyone with an interest in film will certainly enjoy. And it's certainly a good primer if you don't know her stuff that well. You can start your list with the films mentioned in this movie. She accomplished quite a bit in her years behind it, in front of the camera. She was a woman with vision who always managed to see something new and interesting and valuable in everyday things and everyday people. It's very clear that in her final years between this and Faces Places that she remained like sharp and thoughtful and just saw the world as sort of one big potential. She departed this world with a very specific movie, and it feels like the most fitting ending she could have ever filmed. So, yeah, I highly recommend it.
I can't wait to see it. I cannot wait to see it. She's one of my favorites. When I saw Vagabond, the first time I saw Vagabond back in 1985, I was so blown away by it. And then there's just a treasure trough of stuff that she made before that. She'd already been, by that point, she'd already been making movies for like 20 years.
Oh, yeah.
And so I went back and I just dug in. I went to Facets and just went nuts. And I still think she's one of the greatest filmmakers ever, and I'm very excited about this.
I think one of my personal favorites is one called The Gleaners and I.
Oh,
and
man.
Which I remember that so well only because I remember she showed up to festivals dressed like a potato.
Right.
And because that's sort of a primary part of that film. And like I said, she was always championing people living on the fringe, and that was definitely that movie.
And she also made a sequel to it, which was also pretty great. But yeah, no, yeah. great filmmaker, and it's playing exclusively at the Music Box. So there you go. All right, Eric, why don't you tell us about I See You?
Okay, this is a film that premiered at South by Southwest this year, and as the film opens, we see a boy riding his bike through the woods, and then seemingly without warning, just seems to be yanked by some mysterious force off of his bike, and who knows what happens to him, because he becomes part of apparently a series of children that have been disappearing in this town. The detective on the case is played by John Tenney, And the movie then sort of shifts to what's going on in his own home, things that might actually be connected to things that are going on. His wife is played by Helen Hunt, whose basic defining characteristic is that she has apparently had an affair that is very much taking up the minds of not just her husband, but also their teenage son, who very much resents what she has done to this family. There might be another force going on in their home. As more mysterious things begin to happen, people get locked in closets, and you know, things tend to move on their own. So we're not exactly sure what exactly is going on in this house. Is it haunted, or you know what could possibly be happening in this town that is now starting to manifest itself on this home? And that's pretty much all you want to hear about the plot.
Okay, all right, Eric, hang on. Eric, hang on.
Okay.
All right, we'll take a quick break. Eric Childress and Steve Procopio are here. We're doing the Sunday night / Monday morning movie reviews, and we'll hear more about the movie I See You after we take a break here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN with our new show times here. We're on from 11 p.m. to 4 a.m. every weekday morning. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke just a little bit earlier than he usually did. And we've got the Monday morning movie reviews, which are now the Sunday night / Monday morning movie reviews since we start earlier. And so thrilled to have an extra hour with you guys and starting earlier. It's a lot of fun. We're having a good time. So 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text at any time. Rod Pyle is going to join us. Always have a great time with him. We're going to talk space, lots of stories, and lots of really cool things to talk with Rod about. More. We're going to give you some shopping tips as well for this holiday season. 312-981-7200 is the phone number, and it is the Sunday night, Monday morning movie reviews. Eric Childress and Steve Procopi join me. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay, before the break, by the way, I'm looking at the IMDb page for this movie for I See You. Have you seen the poster?
Probably.
I remember. I have seen it, yes.
It's what the hell? I don't even I don't really understand.
I'm looking at it more closely now. Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, it makes sense to me.
Because you've seen the movie.
Yes.
Okay. Well, it just looks like, you know what it looks like? It looks like just the face of the monkey that slams the cymbals together.
You're close.
That's pretty good. I was going to say it looks like the turtle aliens from Laser Blast.
Laser Blast.
That's right.
Oh, I saw that movie twice at the Davis when I was a kid. All right, well, let's get back to it. I'm sorry, I found the poster to be a little weird, and I had one of them.
Yeah, I don't think I've seen that poster.
Yeah, it's a little weird.
That's a good poster, actually, for this movie.
I mean, it is a good poster. I think it's pretty cool. All right, well, okay, let's get back into it, Eric. I See You.
Yeah, so as I was saying right before the break, I don't want to go too far into revealing anything more about the plot because I wouldn't want to dare going into the numerous twists and turns that this movie takes. On the other hand, if I did go any bit further, people would start to realize just how ridiculous this movie actually is. It's very hard to talk about exactly where this film goes wrong, although it goes wrong pretty early on. The acting in this film is so rote, so over the top. The teenage son is particularly bad. Helen Hunt seems like she's lost in this entire enterprise, like she just wandered onto the set and, you know, got just suckered into doing something that gives her character absolutely no depth whatsoever. So she just seems to be this pawn on in this entire game, and that's exactly what that character feels like from the beginning. The moment she sets foot on screen, but as the film sort of just continues to unveil itself, I mean, the first it's kind of divided into like three different, it's three different very distinct kind of movies in a way. Where when we get into the second part of the movie, it sort of goes back into the past and it starts revealing things that connect to the first part of the movie, and then it goes even more nutso in the final third of the movie where everything is revealed exactly what's going on, and it's just really flat out stupid. The first third of the movie with the kind of the haunted house kind of feel that it's going for feels like someone like picked bits of screenplays out of the garbage at Blumhouse Productions and just kind of pasted them and threw darts at them on the on some wall. And then the second part of the movie, which should be a comedy, actually, the second part of the movie is so outlandish and, like, especially nonsensical considering what you've just witnessed. Like, oh, we're going to do this movie now? And it just seems like that should be a more of a dark comedy or even just a weird, wacky comedy than the kind of sort of pseudo, you know, psychological terror that is trying to introduce. If they were trying to go for that, they should have just made that the entire movie instead of trying to use that as an attempt to pull the rug out from under you. It's a sort of weird gaslighting thing that's going on in the film. And then the third part of the movie is just kind of, you know, just routine kind of stuff that you've seen, you know, hundreds of times before. Again, very poorly acted by the people responsible. And it's just, I mean, this movie is just kind of I don't know. I mean, it's a really tough movie to wrap your head around because you kind of get the idea that they were purposely trying to just continue to pull the rug out from the audience, but do so in such mystifyingly stupid ways that it's kind of amazing that anyone signed on to it in the first place. So, yeah, I cannot recommend ICU.
Okay. All right. Steve, what about you?
I don't think Eric and I are that far off, but I actually enjoyed the boldness of the whole thing and the chances the movie took. Admiring it is not the same as liking it, but
right.
I think I can talk about a little bit deeper into it than Eric did without giving anything away. Like he said, at about the third of the way through, the filmmakers basically rewind the movie, and you see a lot of the same events that you saw in the first part through the eyes of another couple. And in a lot of ways, it completely diffuses the tension of the beginning of the movie, which is probably the best part of the film, because at least it's a little bit scary and nerve-wracking, but the second part isn't, it's still fascinating to me, and I know people in this world, like regular thinking people, that are actually genuinely terrified of the thing that happens is actually happening in this movie, happening to them. So it's like a real thing. I can't believe Blumhouse doesn't have its name on the front of this thing because this is right up their alley. But the last third of the film where we actually get back to this child kidnapping or murder thing is ridiculous, and it is pretty much cookie cutter standard issue stuff. The surprises aren't nearly that surprising, certainly not as much as the filmmakers think it is. But at the same time, like I wasn't as put off by the first, I think Eric used the word shift, the first shift in the film. I was actually like, oh, okay, I've never seen this done exactly like this before, so that's fine. So I don't think films should be predictable, and I don't think we should ever get too comfortable with how stories are told, but it doesn't always work when you try out new stuff. But hey, I give the guy credit, and I should call out his name. His name is Adam Randall. I think it's his second feature. I'm kind of curious to see what he does from this point forward. Because, like I said, he's clearly not afraid to take a few risks. We just got to get him a better script. And I like there's this sort of subtext about the family falling apart in the midst of this chilling investigation about other families being torn apart by these disappearances. that's about the most poignant thing about that I could say about the film. You know, it's a small under the radar thing that if you're just trying to get away from all the awards contenders in theaters right now, I'm not sure why you would be, but if you are, it's, you know, it's playing at Facets so for the rest of the week. So there you go.
It's at Facets?
Yeah.
All right. Okay. All right.
Right, right next to the Agnes Varda movie.
Right, exactly. All right. Hang on a second, okay, guys?
Yeah.
All right. That's Eric and Steve. The movie was I See You with Helen Hunt, a weird one, from what I understand. And welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Skyline studio here on a Sunday night slash Monday morning. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke. Rod Pyle, our space expert, is going to join us to hang out. And also, the news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom right here on WGN. As you can tell, it is time for the Sunday night slash Monday morning movie reviews. Eric Childress and Steve Procopi join me every week to talk about all the new movies. And then Eric sticks around. We talk about box office as well. So let's bring the guys back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay, Steve, why don't you tell us about Playmobil the movie?
Yes. Remember the Lego movie? Remember, this is like that, but with none of the licensing agreements in place. So this is, unlike the Lego movie, this actually opens with live action. So we meet a girl named Marla, who's played by Anya Taylor-Joy, who's about to graduate high school, and she's sort of psyching herself up to tell her parents she wants to take a year off from college to travel and see the world, and with her newly acquired passport, and she's sort of telling her younger brother, Charlie, who's played by Gabriel Bateman, who we just saw as Andy in the new Child's Play movie. She's telling him this, and so she's sort of getting excited, and then their parents die. And, in a horrible car accident.
Oh my
and
God.
So all of her dreams are pushed to the side because she's 18 and she can take care of, she's old enough to take care of her brother. This movie is kind of bizarre, but, anyway, so she's sort of forced to put all her dreams and travel plans on hold and to raise her brother, and he's such a hateful little kid that after a couple years of this that he makes this job more difficult for her so anyway he when Charlie sort of unexpectedly disappears into this magical animated universe of Playmobil, which I guess they used to play with those toys when they were younger, unprepared Marla has to kind of go on a quest in this animated form to bring him home, and she sets off on this journey across all these new worlds, and she teams up with some heroic new friends and goes up against some silly villains, and there's people like a fast-talking, kind of con artist-y food truck driver who's played by Jim Gaffigan. There's sort of a dashing, generic, charismatic secret agent voiced by Daniel Radcliffe. There's misfit robots and fairy godmother that singer Meghan Trainor voices. And there's all these things that sort of they want to stop Charlie from getting thrown into this sort of gladiatorial showdown at the hands of the evil Emperor Maximus, who I believe is voiced by Adam Lambert. But anyway, did I mention this is a musical too?
Oh yeah.
No, there's actually singing in this, and right off at the top, Anya Taylor-Joy belts out a song about dreams and adventures of her own, So yeah, the through their sort of adventure, Marla and Charlie realize that no matter how life plays out, you can achieve anything when you believe in it and yourself. And you know, insert fart sound here. So yeah, it feels and looks like a third tier Lego movie with generic, stereotypical characters. The story is basically just one cliche after another. The voice talent does a decent job pulling out some laughs and urgency to the proceedings, but like, man, with this music, when you put it out 2 weeks after Frozen 2, which has some really beautiful songs in it, the music here is just so forgettable and like entry-level pop garbage, with sort of vague lyrics, like I said, about dreams and adventures and holding on to hope. I suppose the kids who actually care or even know what Playmobil is, and I do, I remember them, they might like it, but for the rest of you, and admittedly, I'm not the target audience, I know that, but it's a pretty brutal viewing, so I am not recommending it.
Okay. I can't believe that the movie opens with the death of the parents.
Yeah.
I still can't get past that.
Oh, yeah, and it's jarring. Like,
Lord. All right.
Yeah.
All right, Eric, what about you?
I like you, and you haven't even seen the movie. I saw it. I couldn't get past how this movie opens. The entire movie, I kept revisiting. Like, you know, every like 10 minutes, I would get bored with basically with the adventures that are going on, and I would just sit there and I go like, wait a minute, did this movie open with a song by Anya Taylor-Joy that then ends with the police showing up at their front door telling them that the parents, I mean, it's like this movie, you know, for 15 minutes, we don't even get into the animation, and for all those 15 minutes, I keep thinking just like this movie is basically just setting itself up to be some weirdo version, the nightmare of Labyrinth meets Midsommar, and it just so strange. I mean, the best thing I can say about the animated stuff, and once we get into it, is that it's just basically generic stuff. And you know, it's kind of a, you know, Steve just mentioned, you know, like just a couple minutes ago, that you know we should never get used to, you know, stories, you know, finding new ways to present themselves, and this is proof positive right here. You know, you're certainly not going to get used to this. And you know, it's bold for Playmobil, the people behind this, to basically live up to the name of Playmobil. That's basically, you know, the kids who ask for Legos for Christmas and then ends up getting Playmobil is a very disappointed child. And that's exactly what this movie kind of feels like. I mean, it's Lego movies in reverse. So everything that we came to love about the Lego movie, that you know, ultimately is this storyline sprung from a child's imagination.
Okay, Eric, hang on, Eric.
Okay,
hold on. We'll finish up talking about this movie, but we got a break here for the news. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline studio here, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. Coming up in just a little bit, our buddy Rod Pyle is going to join us. He's a space expert, a journalist, lots of space stories to talk about, and it's always a blast when Rod is here. We've got some shopping tips that we're going to give you. And we are also going to talk about some lies that your parents told you as a kid. So all of that and more. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. You can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show, and also stay connected on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/Nick D Show. It is the Sunday night slash Monday. Well, now it's Monday morning. The Monday morning movie reviews continue. Eric Childress and Steve Procopi join me every week to talk about the movies and also talk about box office as well. Before the break, Eric was still talking about this Playmobil movie. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Thanks.
Okay, continue with what you were saying about this Playmobil or Playmobil or whatever the hell it is movie.
It is Playmobil.
It's Playmobil, okay.
It is Playmobil?
It is. Playmobil. I remember these toys.
I never remember calling it Mobile, though.
Yeah. It's Playmobil. They say it in the movie.
Okay, I wasn't paying attention. Anyway,
either.
So I mean, ultimately, there's not much to the movie, and you know, it kind of just shamelessly rips off stuff from Star Wars. I mean, Jim Gaffigan, plays this character who runs a food truck that is going to transport the Playmobil Anya Taylor-Joy to find her brother in this world, and of course, he's only doing it to get his debt paid. And, okay, so shades of Han Solo, and then when we find out exactly who he has to pay off, it literally is a female Jabba the Hutt, and not, an actual Jabba the Hutt, because as Steve mentioned, they don't have the licensing for anything in this movie. It's just a ridiculously generic piece of work that's trying to cash in on another brand name and just doing it also forgettably.
Okay, well, there you go. That's the it made no money over the weekend, right?
No, it made a historically low amount of money.
Okay, well, I'm just trying to figure out what the target audience for this is. I guess were they trying to tap into the Lego thing?
Clearly, yeah. I mean, this movie's been sitting on the shelf for a while, and it was originally being put out by Open Road Films, and then they shuttered, so the film was sort of laying in limbo until FDX decided to pick it up.
Okay. All right.
Yeah,
well,
so
there
the kid
it is.
In the movies, I think, is much younger than he is in Child's Play.
Oh. Oh. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. That's a little off-putting. All right. All right.
The only thing that would have made it worth going to see is if the police who came to the door had thrown the severed heads of the two parents into the living room. Then I would have maybe recommended.
Wow. There you go. All right. All right, Eric. Tell us about the Aeronauts.
Okay, this film is based on a true story, based on a very interesting true story, although a lot of liberties are taken with it. Eddie Redmayne plays a scientist who is trying to convince everyone in the 1860s in London that the weather can be predicted. They're laughing him out of the room and whatnot, but he, says, if he can get up there and, measure, study the weather up close in a hot air balloon, he might be able to prove that such things, can be predicted, and obviously that would, help possibly save lives and all kinds of things that you can do to study with the weather going forward. But he needs a pilot, and Felicity Jones's character just happens to be one, and has flown some hot air balloons in the past, but a tragedy in her past has kind of sworn her off doing it again, but she eventually reluctantly agrees to be a part of this experiment, but she has kind of a flare and a flash all her own that runs counter to Eddie Redmayne's more straight-laced, all-business scientist type. So the two of them are, kind of clashing, and as they take off on their, illustrious adventure. But we'll eventually, grow, close to each other when certain instances occur on their trip that causes them to, look out for each other's lives, clearly. So this is a movie that it kind of follows the kind of the old classic line about a movie having three really good scenes and no bad scenes, and that equals a good movie. I'm paraphrasing, of course, because this movie totally has three great scenes in the movie, great sequences in the movie, all taking place, obviously, on the hot air balloon adventure that they're going through. But this movie is hampered by its structure in that it wants to break up our time in the balloon with these two characters, with flashbacks revealing exactly how they eventually got to this place, which to me is a kind of an enormous lapse in judgment, because every time we move away from the hot air balloon, we lose a little bit of sense of the claustrophobia and danger that, you know, clearly comes with being, you know, tens of thousands of feet in the air, with, you know, with nothing underneath. So the flashback scenes, are really just kind of, they really get in the way. If they had just kind of played this movie straight and done it in a more linear fashion, we could have gotten that stuff out of the way. It might not have been as interesting, but at least it would have been leading up to what would have been this really fantastic thing. Because we don't see a lot of hot air balloon adventure stories, and certainly not one that is done with enough flair and some really great special effects that this one does once we're in that balloon with them. I also think this is a movie that could have actually benefited a bit by kind of leaning into the science a little bit more. It seems like once they're in the air, a lot of it comes down to just like, look how high we are, and we've broken another record, and all this kind of stuff. And we don't really get a great sense of exactly what they're doing up in that balloon, other than climbing higher and then trying to survive. But like I said, this movie has three really great sequences in that balloon, and I think this is one of the good points for an argument about cinema versus what you end up watching at home on television, because this movie is eventually going to be streaming on Amazon, which they just did with the report a couple of weeks ago, and they're going to be dealing with this movie as well, and it just seems like if you see this movie in a theater and if the music box is playing in 70mm, you're really going to gain something from that experience. Seeing it at home, I think you're eventually going to lose something. So I saw this movie in a theater. I saw it at the Toronto Film Festival in a screening room, so not quite as glorious as the music box. And so I'm kind of mixed on the whole thing. Like I really like the scenes in the balloon, but the flashback structure really kind of takes away from it. So I'm ultimately kind of mixed on it, but if you do get a chance to see this movie in a theater, I think people will like it more than I did.
Okay. All right. Okay, Steve, you guys are showing it at the Music Box in 70, right?
Apparently we're the only ones showing it, period, which I didn't realize at first, but I just looked it up, and yeah, because it's another, you know, streaming service like Netflix, and the big chains don't want those movies because they can't hold them for months on end if they want to. But anyway, besides that, Eric's right though. Like the flashback stuff is going to be the problematic stuff for a lot of people. Not only do they interrupt the forward motion of the much more interesting part of this story, but I don't even think much of the information we get in those flashbacks is particularly useful or interesting. You know, there's stuff about Eddie Redmayne's character's father, who's clearly going through some sort of Alzheimer's-like disease, and then of course we see this tragedy that with Felicity Jones's character and her sort of coming out of that mourning period. But it's not that. It just doesn't really. I don't really think it adds a whole lot that maybe just mentioning it in conversation between the two of them wouldn't have accomplished just as well. But yeah, man, when they're in that balloon, I liked every second of when they were in that balloon. They don't go deep into the science, but there's a lot of talk in here about measuring air pressure and temperature and oxygen levels and all these like crazy things that happen at each new layer of atmosphere. I mean, it's great, and then there's some like genuinely fantastic action sequences, one during a thunderstorm, one when the balloon is basically frozen and Felicity Jones has to climb on top of it.
That sequence is extraordinary.
Oh my God, it made my stomach just do flips. I couldn't believe it. And there's a great crash sequence at the end that I wasn't expecting either. So yeah, I mean, it's the action stuff kind of just beat it for me, especially I saw it in a screening room too for the first time, and then I caught it again in 70 at the Music Box. But man, and the other thing that a lot of people are getting hung up on is that Felicity Jones' character is an amalgam of a couple different female adventurers of the period. Her name is not one of a real person. Redmayne's character is a real person, but I mean, look, it doesn't bother me. You're not watching a documentary. I never really got hung up on stuff like that. I know it bothers some people because they're like, why couldn't you just pick one? Well, I'd rather have a made-up character have completely fictional backstories and adventures than assign those things to someone it didn't happen to. So, but anyway, yeah, I mean, and I think these two have a really kind of fun chemistry, and it's kind of nice to see them flipping their roles a bit from the theory of everything, where she's the one basically in charge when they're in the balloon, and he's kind of the passive writer in this situation. I think people are gonna really enjoy this film. So yeah, I'm recommending it with reservations about it, and in full admission that these flashback scenes are a pain to watch.
Okay. All right, you guys hang on a second, okay?
Yep.
All right, Eric and Steve are here. We're gonna take a quick break and we'll come back and we'll talk more here. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we're live in the Skyline studio here until 4 a.m. My dad will call in and tell a joke. It's a Monday morning, and we're wrapping up the Monday morning movie reviews, and we'll get into the box office as well. Here's Eric. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Steve, welcome back.
Hello.
All right, I realized that I didn't see any movies this week, except that I did. Because I was just made a huge dent in the screeners, so I did see a lot of movies. I just didn't see anything that came out this week. So, all right, what do we got next week?
Lots. We got the new Jumanji sequel opening next week.
Mm-hmm.
We have Richard Jewell, Clint Eastwood's new movie, and we have the latest remake of Black Christmas. I think Seabird is still opening.
I don't know
somewhere.
If that's true. I
don't know anymore. I can't trust certain calendars in this town.
I feel like since it's sort of been taken out of awards consideration because a lot of people don't like it that much, maybe they pushed it to next year. Nick, I did want to mention one thing that's opening next week that has a nice component to it. There's a film opening at Facets next week called Colwell. It opens December 13th, and on the 13th and 14th, so the Friday and Saturday, the film stars Karen Allen. I think the film has been nominated for a couple Independent Spirit Awards this year, including one for Karen Allen for Best Lead Female or whatever the categories are. But one of the other stars of the film, a person you know named Kevin J. O'Connor, is actually going to be at the screenings on Friday and Saturday.
Oh, cool.
And you can look at facets.org for the specific show times. I think he's going to be at three different shows.
Oh, cool.
But, yeah, people should, and I've heard a lot of good things about it. I will, it's playing for a whole week, and I'll probably review it next week. But yeah, I wanted to tell people about those shows on Friday and Saturday.
Sure. Kevin's a great guy.
Yeah.
Great guy, terrific actor, too. So,
yeah.
All right. Well, that's cool. All right. Well, Steve, thanks, man. We'll talk to you next week.
All right, take care.
Here's Steve. Right. He'll join us next week. Eric, let's jump into the box office, shall we?
Sure.
Were we surprised by any of the numbers this weekend?
Not at all, really. Okay. I mean, everything was pretty much the same with the exception of Dark Waters got an expansion this week and made a very unremarkable $4 million in that expansion. Not particularly good.
Okay.
I mean, Frozen 2 taking the top spot is to no one's surprise.
Right.
The film has now grossed over $919 million worldwide.
That's crazy.
Yeah, and Disney is about to become, sometime probably the next day or so, the first studio ever to produce a $10 billion a year at the movie.
Yeah, I got that story right in front of me. I was going to bring it up to you.
Yeah.
Crossing the record $10 billion at worldwide box office, the first studio in history to hit that mark.
Yeah, and they have this little movie called Star Wars still coming out.
Right.
Yeah, so it's amazing. So they're going to hit $11 billion by the time this thing is over.
Yeah, wow. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Yeah. Well, all right, let's continue here. So Frozen 2, number one, $34.6 million. Total in America, $337.5
million.
And then number two, Knives Out, $14.1 million, 63, almost $64 million. That's pretty good.
It's doing very well. No, it's over $120 million worldwide right now. And this, I mean, the movie only cost like $40 million. So this movie is already in the profit for Lionsgate. And it's still on a $100 million pace.
Yeah.
So it's roughly about the same pace that Ford versus Ferrari is on, which we're going to talk about in just a second.
Yeah. Knives Out makes me, I don't know why, it just pleases me that it's making money.
Oh, totally.
Just very,
it's going to bring back the whodunit.
Yeah.
I mean, we'll probably get a lot of bad whodunits now as a result of it. But that's okay. I like bad whodunits, too.
Yeah. All right. Number three, Ford versus Ferrari, $6.5 million, $91 million total. This is not good.
It's not good, yeah, compared to the budget. I mean, a movie makes $100 million, and everyone goes like, oh, it's a hit. Well, you know, not really, because this movie cost somewhere around $90 to $100 million, depending on who you talk to. And the film has only made about $160-some million worldwide, where it's got to get around $240, $250 before it starts talking profit. So
wow.
This could be another loser for Fox,
wow,
even with those numbers.
Number four, Queen and Slim, $6.5 million, $26 million total.
Yeah, on a pace for right around $40 million, which is not bad for a small-budget film like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Number five, A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, $5.2 million, bringing its total up to $43. I was hoping that would make more money.
I think my heart got over my head on this one a bit. I thought that this movie was going to really kind of inspire people. This period, and I don't know. I don't know if they just people thought that they just didn't want to see a movie about Mr. Rogers, or people didn't want to forget about Mr. I don't know why this film didn't turn out to be that big a hit. I'm that being said, it's one of the few movies this year where you actually can track that word of mouth has been very positive to it, because it's one of only four wide releases this year that have actually grossed more than four times their opening weekend, which this film is eventually going to. It's not quite there yet, but it is going to get there. So the word of mouth is clearly very good on this movie. Critics like it. Tom Hanks is likely to get a nomination out of it. But 55, 60 million, which is where this movie seems to be headed, I thought this movie was going to clear 100 million easy.
I thought so, too. I did, and I'm disappointed because it's really terrific.
Yeah.
He's great. He's great in it. Number six, Dark Water, is $4.1 million. Is it just that people don't want to see this because it seems like a pretty depressing movie? And do we really want to see a movie about DuPont poisoning people?
Well, people saw Civil Action.
Yeah,
Civil Action actually did pretty well back in the day, and that was, Travolta was still not kind of riding his high after Pulp Fiction for a few years.
Right.
So people went and saw Civil Action, and that's a very depressing movie.
Yeah.
I don't think that, exactly. People, just not the kind of movie you want to see, especially during the holidays.
Right. Right, and Mark Ruffalo's not playing Hulk, so it's not going to bring anybody. He's not the biggest.
Right, no, he's playing Mark
box
Ruffalo.
Office draw, yeah. Number seven, 21 Bridges, $2.8 million, $23 million total. That's not good.
Not at all.
Okay. Number eight, Playing with Fire. Playing with Fire, $2 million, almost $42 million for the John Cena family comedy.
Yeah, how many people on their box office holiday card had Playing with Fire outgrossing both Last Christmas and Dr. Sleep?
Whew, that's crazy.
Yeah.
Right. Number nine, Midway, $1.9 million, $53 million. Now, that's not good considering how much it cost to make, right? Wasn't it?
No, this movie's a disaster.
Yeah.
This movie cost $100 million. Like I said, the international prospects were not very high because America wins, and who wants to see that? And so this movie is all the good vibes that Knives Out is creating for Lionsgate. It's basically wiping up the losses that Midway has given them.
Mm. All right, and then this thing is still in the top 10. Joker, $1 million. It's up to $332 million just in America.
Yeah, passed the Aladdin remake this year on the charts, so it is now the 34th highest grossing film of all time.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah.
I mean, really. All right.
I don't get it.
Yeah, I don't either, man. I don't either. So is Jumanji going to take over the top spot next week?
Yeah, Jumanji will take over next week. I think Jumanji is going to have a very healthy run if people like it. I don't think it's not going to do as good as the first one. I'd be very shocked by that. But it should have a very solid opening, and it was going to play all through Christmas Vacation. So, yeah, Jumanji is going to do very good. I'm very curious to see how Richard Jewell is going to do.
Yeah, you know,
if this is a movie that is like, do we really want to see this during the holidays, or is this going to be a bit of a feel-good? It's not really a feel-good movie, but certain crowds are going to take away from this movie more than other crowds will.
Yeah,
I'll just say that.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. I mean, you know, because it's Clint, and there's another remake of Black Christmas, which is not only
which they're not screening here in Chicago.
I'm not shocked by that. Yet another needless remake of Black Christmas, and yet this one PG-13. I don't know.
The first remake was R, right?
Yes.
Yeah, it was. And it was like, it's one of the worst remakes I've ever seen.
Ever. Yeah.
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 So it's got to be better than that,
yeah.
I guess.
Mm. when does Uncut Gems open here?
Christmas.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure it's Christmas Day. That opens, yes, Christmas Day.
Okay.
Perfect Christmas movie for the family.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, take your heart medication and go see Uncut Gems.
Oh, man. I'm telling you, I think Sandler's getting nominated. I think he's getting nominated.
It's a loaded category, man.
Yeah, I know, but man. I don't know.
I know. He's great.
He's so great.
Yeah.
I mean, it's such a great performance. Everybody.
No, it really is, man. I think in any other year, I think he'd be a real serious possibility.
Yeah.
I'm not ruling it out, but I'm just saying that, you know, if you have to get, you know, you have to negotiate De Niro and, you know, Joaquin Phoenix and DiCaprio and, you know, so many people in there. And they're going to go, yeah, let's give Adam Sandler the nomination.
You know what? He deserves it, though. I mean,
I'm not arguing.
Adam Sandler is, I never thought I would say this, but Adam Sandler deserves an Oscar. I never thought, and I never ever thought I would say that, ever.
Yeah. But, well, you said it once with Robin Williams,
and
the world's greatest dad, so, I mean, anything's possible.
Well, I mean, look, Sandler was great in Punch Drunk Love, but this is just, like, he carries this movie. He's in every scene.
Oh, yeah.
And not only does he carry it, but my God, the energy that has to be taken, you know what I mean? It's just so exhausting to watch the movie and watch what he has to do and negotiate and do all this crazy stuff and dig a hole even bigger. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, dude, stop. You know?
Right. It's just like, you just want to reach out to the screen and just like, dude, just take a breath.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and it's like, even when he has a bit of an out to get out of something, he goes the completely the wrong path. Like, no, dude, go, no!
Yeah,
don't
no,
do
I
that.
Know. But it's a great movie. It really is a great
movie.
Yeah,
it is.
I think it's one of the best of the year. All right, Eric, we will talk to you next week. Thanks, buddy.
Sounds good, man. Okay.